thank you very much for having me. It's very nice to be with you. And I'd love it if you kept Mark 14 open in front of you, because I'm going to come back and just try and explore something of what Jesus is experiencing at this extraordinary moment in the Garden of Gethsemane. But I want to cut to the chase, because I'm sure that the difficulty of this question is perhaps one of the reasons you're here. And so you're basically hoping to see someone make a bit of a fool of themselves as they try to answer it in less than half an hour. Well, all remains to be seen. But let's be quite clear. After the horrors of the 20th century, let's just confine ourselves to the last 100 years or so. This is, I suspect, easily the hardest question for people who believe in a God of any sort, and certainly for those who believe in the Christian God. Let me state it as boldly as I can, because I think what we're dealing with is effectively the problem with God. God is the problem here. Let me explain. You see, if you believed in the ancient Roman and Greek gods, you know, Zeus and Aphrodite and all that lot, then suffering was not a problem. It was not a problem. It was just par for the course. Because basically the ancient gods were just the extremes of human behavior sort of writ deified, writ large. So there they were on top of Mount Olympus behaving appallingly, and we just sort of were at their mercy. We were sort of playthings, like sort of pawns on a chessboard. But the cruelty of the human predicament is that there's nothing we can do about it. And many people rejected that idea of gods and goddesses who were just sort of playing with us for all kinds of different reasons. But that is completely alien, very different from how God is presented within the Christian worldview, within the Bible. And let me put the problem at its most stark. The description of God in the Bible is pretty consistent. There are things that we struggle to work out how they fit, but generally the claim is pretty clear, and this God has three key features when it comes to the issue of suffering. The first is that he is wise. The second is that he is good. And the third is that he is powerful. And basically, it's the combination of the three, a sort of three-legged stool, that is precisely why this is a problem. If you just have two of them, it explains everything. You can live with it. So basically, if he's powerful but not wise, then you can just say, well, he's not clever enough to sort it all out. If he's wise and powerful but not good, then, well, he doesn't care. If he's wise and good but not powerful, then, well, he'd love to do something about it, but he just can't. Much as we might sort of read things in the newspaper and say, gosh, I wish I had a magic wand to sort out that problem. Well, God is the same. Okay, so at its most stark, the problem lies in the fact that the Bible and Christian theology for the last 2,000 years has insisted that God is all three together. So the issue is, how on earth can you hold on to them? Yeah, you can hold on to two, but not three. How is that possible? So hopefully you see the problem. Because you see, for many people, especially after the last century, the idea of God is just frankly impossible, if not obscene. They say there can't be a God at all after what we have witnessed and what is indeed going on around our world today. How can God allow, say, 100 people killed and 500 injured when government planes struck down the town of Khan Shaykhun with sarin and other toxic chemicals in April 2017 in Syria? I don't know. How can God allow 4,300 to die in the Sulawesi earthquake in Indonesia in September 2018? I don't know. How can God allow 1,300 to die in Cyclone Idai across one of the poorest regions in the world, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi? The most vulnerable. with the least resources to deal with the aftermath. I was in Zimbabwe about 2 weeks after it happened. It was devastating. How can God allow that? I don't know. How can God allow the people I really care for, my friends and family, to die slowly of cancer or some other grim disease? Or dare I say it, even the threat of a global pandemic. I don't know. If God is all wise, all good, all powerful, I simply do not get it. And you'll have your own list. Perhaps it's a very present, a very real list. Maybe it's something that you're right in the middle of. The existence of evil and suffering is a problem for a God-created universe. Now, if you are in the middle of something, then metaphorically, I just want to give you a hug, basically, because actually answers are the last thing you probably want or need. But maybe for some, it's not as immediate, and this is an opportunity just to sort of try and begin to get your head around things. And I want to just give one or two avenues that maybe you can think about afterwards as a way of getting to grips with it. So the existence of evil and suffering is a problem for those who believe in God. But here's the dilemma. Because you see, the atheist has an equally tricky problem. It's not the same. It's a kind of opposite side. Because the atheist problem is, how do you explain the existence of beauty and goodness in a godless universe? In fact, why do we think that things are beautiful? Why do we long for things to be good or better? It's not as easy a question as you might think. If there is no God, if we are just skinfuls of chemicals, we are the products of an accidental chemical reaction, how is it possible? Atheism, to my mind, has never actually answered this satisfactorily. Okay, so that if that is the case, and the only sort of explanation why we have these kind of desires and senses about the universe and about life, then that casts us back onto our original question. Okay, so if theism, if God exists, what do we do when it comes to suffering? Now, you wouldn't expect me just to sort of sort it all out in these few minutes. So I'm not even going to try. But what I do want to do is to look at a very particular experience that Jesus Christ had in those hours just before he died. And I want to avoid sort of philosophizing and theorizing and sitting in an ivory tower. This is gritty and real. This is grounded and down to earth. And I want to see whether this experience has anything to say to the problem. So have Mark 14 there, and we'll look at one or two things. And I've called this the horror of Gethsemane. The horror of Gethsemane, because actually this was a terrifying moment for Jesus. Have a bit, drop more. And a while back I was reading a fascinating book. It was called JFK's Last 100 Days by Thurston Clark. And he basically goes through week by week of the last weeks of Kennedy's life as president. And of course, the poignancy of this book is that we know what's going to happen. Thanks so much. We know that he will be assassinated. And so it's like a sort of countdown. It's all these sort of decisions, and it's like one of those movies where, you know, they turn the whole thing inside out and they put the end at the beginning, so you know how it's going to end. But all the time where you have these sort of choices and moments, you're thinking, but just don't do that. can't we just change how it's going to end? But of course, November 1963, he was assassinated. If Kennedy had lived, our world would be a very different place. The Cold War would have been a very different war. All kinds of things. It's almost unimaginable. Why did God allow JFK to be killed? Couldn't someone have thwarted the assassin just at the last minute? Or why did it have to happen? And there's just one of a billion questions. I don't know the answer. Terrible things happen, and people do terrible things to other people. One of the weirdest things in reading this book, though, is that several of his closest friends who were with him on and off during those last 100 days, several of them noted how he became increasingly obsessed with the idea of assassination. It was very weird. He was obsessed about Lincoln and how Lincoln spent those months before his own assassination. It was almost as if, you know, he knew that there were people who hated him in the country. It was almost as if he was resigned to something happening. It was really quite weird. But he forged on. He knew that going to Dallas was dangerous, but he forged on. There had been threats, but he forged on, hoping against hope, I guess. Or just thinking, no, that can't really happen. But we come to Jesus' last hours, and Gethsemane really is, you know, the beginning of the end. He's not like JFK at all. The contrast couldn't be greater in some ways. Let's just have a look through. And we find that various sort of experiences he has during that night are really grim. So verse 33-34, we find that he is deeply traumatized. It's hard to know exactly why that is, but it's almost as if the writer, in this case Mark, can't quite get the words to articulate the depths of his pain and trauma. He's desperate not to be alone, and yet all his chums have fallen asleep. And he's troubled to the point of death, which is a very strange way of describing it. But of course, we know what is about to happen. But it's not sort of resignation, it's a kind of terror. And verse 35, it really does seem genuinely that he is terrified and terrorized. Verse 35, he prays to God for a different future. Take this cup from me, he says. If only there could be another way, he says. Please, please, take it away. Now, this is not resignation. This is terrified reluctance. Jesus, this one that countless millions around the world worship. And he's terrified. And then we see he's deserted. Verses 37 and 38, it's the early hours, those awful hours. If you sometimes struggle to sleep, it's those sort of hours of 2 till 4 in the morning. Nobody is around. It's completely dark and lonely and miserable. And there he is. He can hear the snores around, you know, the hedges and bushes of this garden. He's alone. And, you know, they've been traveling for months, most of the time on foot, if not all the time on foot. They've been going around for several years. Everybody's exhausted. They're confused. They don't really know what's going on. They certainly have no clue what's about to happen. Jesus is the only one, even though he's tried to give them the heads up. Keep me company, he says. It's all I ask. But they can't. His friends have deserted him. And then he's betrayed. Verse 42. I mean, betrayal is only possible by a friend. A stranger does not betray. A stranger does whatever a stranger does in these circumstances, but it's not betrayal. This can only be done by a friend, a confidant. So much so that now this man's name has become a byword for betrayal, being a Judas. And then in chapters 14 and 15, you can read on in your own time, but we see arrest, trial, execution. This is dark. And yet he's the one countless millions worship. Now, why does Jesus suffer? That's the sort of key question at the heart of this. Why? Why does he seem to suggest this cup, whatever that means, could be taken away? And then why does he say, no, not my will, but yours, I'm going to do this? Why? Why does, by implication, he embrace something that petrified him? Well, I want to do something a little unorthodox, because you might think this is just a case of man's inhumanity to man. But I want to freeze frame this drama at a very specific point. Freeze frame in verse 42. Do you see what he says? Rise up, let us go, here comes my betrayer. Now, I want to ask at this point, with, you know, imagining the frame is frozen with the drama going on in front of us, I want us to imagine, what do you think different types of people might say to Jesus at this moment? He says, let us go and come to my betrayer. Let's meet with him, even though I know who he is, what he's doing, and what will happen. What might you want to say to him at this excruciating moment? I mean, I can't think of many situations that are worse, being betrayed by someone you love. Now, for the nature of the thing, the task, I'm going to have to caricature a little bit, but I want to look at three different worldviews as to how they might advise Jesus. And I'm going to speculate, but just see whether you think this, you know, is plausible. Let's imagine, for starters, that we deal with someone coming from, say, a sort of Eastern mystical mindset. Okay, here's the freeze frame. Jesus is about to do this. What might an Eastern mystical mindset say? Well, they would, if they are influenced by a number of different ideas of suffering, whether from a more Buddhist or Hindu mindset, but particularly, say, a Buddhist mindset, where basically everything is an illusion. Suffering is as much of an illusion as pleasure. And everything that we think exists is actually a mirage. It's not real reality. So I suspect, push comes to shove, they might say to Jesus, well, actually, nothing of what you're experiencing is really real. This is not what it's all about. Just go with the flow. There's no pain, there's no pleasure ultimately, there's no joy, there's no sadness ultimately. All is one. We're all going to end up mashed up together in some great sort of one unity. So I don't know why you're going out of your way to make things worse for yourself. It doesn't make any sense. Just be calm. If you can get away, get away. Because effectively, what is going on here is, I'm caricaturing, I realize, but there is a sense in which we're just going to deny the seriousness of suffering. We're going to say, it doesn't really matter that much. We just got to rise above it. There is no headache. There is no joy. One of the most disturbing images from the Vietnam War, I don't know whether you've seen it, was that monk in Vietnam setting himself on fire. And it was profoundly shocking. And, you know, the photograph went global immediately. And this monk was almost serene, as if this wasn't real, as his body began to burn. He's almost in a trance. And compared to that Buddhist monk, who is an extraordinary person, no doubt, but he was a human being, Jesus is the opposite. He's not calm, cool, and collected at all. It's such a mystery. Why does Jesus just go headlong into this when he could so easily have avoided it, or at least gone through with it with much more grace and serenity? Of course, as the hours went on that night, he was very composed and in control of things, but it doesn't fit with what we see in the garden. But then I want to say, is it really fair to deny the reality of pain and say, look, it's not that important? The pain that we go through, to say, no, you just got to rise above it. It's not the really real. I'm not sure, and I've been an ordained pastor for 25 years, I'm not sure that would go down well at a bedside in a hospital. You know, the agonies that you're going through for whatever reason. No, it's not really real. Is it really fair to say it means nothing? Well, I find that actually insensitive, but actually also quite chilling, because actually it belittles the acute pain that people have. And I want to do justice to that. I want to be real with people, and sometimes that is all they want. They don't want a nice easy answer, but they want someone to say, yeah, I get it. Yeah, you are right, this is crappy. It's not fake. And there are no words to describe this. Sometimes that's what you need. There are no words, not because it's irrelevant or meaningless, but because it's beyond words sometimes. Now, there more needs to be said about that, but let me move on. If that one extreme is just to deny the reality of pain, the second one is more familiar, I guess. Is to avoid suffering. Now, you see, if we take a godless universe seriously, in other words, we take seriously the idea that we are just accidents of chemistry and physics, then we've got some thinking to do, because basically there are many questions, and people do noble things, and that might be difficult to explain, but we have to face the reality, as Richard Dawkins does very starkly. I mean, he pushes it as far as he goes. I don't think he will live day to day like this, but he's honest at least. Let me just read you a little bit from his book, River Out of Eden. I don't know whether you can see the t-shirt he's got on, says, "Religion, together we can find the cure." Ho, ho. He doesn't pull any punches. This is what he says. In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. He's absolutely right. If there is no God. Absolutely right. I mean, he uses poetic language, doesn't he? But boy, is it grim. We dance to the music of our DNA. Well, thanks. But he's right. If everything is meaningless, why go through with suffering? Why not avoid it? I mean, it's pretty brainless to sort of go headlong, isn't it? I mean, you've only got your, what, 3 score years and 10 or whatever it is. Why put yourself in harm's way? Far better. It makes much more sense to avoid it. So, Jesus, what on earth are you doing? Get out of there. And perhaps unlike any generational culture before us, modern life gears almost everything to the business of preventing, minimizing, and avoiding pain. Labor-saving devices to assisted suicide. The absolute evil is pain. So a modern secularist looks at Jesus in freeze frame and thinks he must be mad. What on earth are you doing? Suffering is to be avoided. have an easier life. And yet, in verse 42, what does he do? He says, let's go home. No. Here comes my betrayer. We're going to face this head on. So again, the big question is, why? Well, the Christian mindset has a very different option. Verse 36, just go back to that. Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. There is God is powerful. You can do it. You can do it. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. Some of the most perplexing and perhaps even chilling words ever uttered in human history. He's not like JFK, sort of resigned to an unknown future. This is a man who, for whatever reason, climbs down out of the carriage onto the train track and walks headlong into an express train. Why? If he is God's son, if he is divinity, if he is God getting his feet muddy on earth, as Christians believe, what on earth is he playing at? Well, the answer lies in the purpose in all this. But please, first understand, suffering and evil are not a good in themselves. There's no masochism here. We are right to be appalled, to rant and rail against it, and ultimately to rant and rail against death. That is our last enemy. It is wrong. We are not meant to die. That is why we feel such pain. Not just at the end of someone we love, their life, but at the fact of death. And Jesus did that. He wept when a close friend died, even though he knew he was going to bring him back to life. There was something so intrinsically wrong about this. But here's the thing. The process of suffering somehow, stupefyingly, extraordinarily, be a means to bringing about good. And we know that from life. Take the agonies of chemotherapy for cancer. It must be endured, but it brings good. That is the point. You don't do it otherwise. No one does chemotherapy for fun. I've seen it in my family enough. There's nothing fun about it, but you do it for a purpose. Or take the decades Mandela endured prison. That was in itself a key factor in the moral victory over apartheid and the ability to forgive afterwards. It was a key factor in what happened in 94 in South Africa. Jesus endured the horror of the cross for the glory he knew would come. The triumph of justice, a resounding cry of hope. You see, the point of this cup in verse 36 is the cup of God's just response to our sinfulness, our rebellion against him, our decision to live in God's world as if it was ours. You know, it's ours. This is my life. I can do what I like with it. This is my world. This is my place. These are my people. It's my call. And we forget that actually, no, it's his. And the reality is, this is the cup we all face. But as I close, here's the amazing thing. We face God's justice and we need God's justice. Just read your newspaper. But Jesus says, give me that cup. I'll drink it down to the dregs. I'll drink it. So you don't need to. You see, the Christian mindset is built on the idea that Christ has defeated suffering. He has dealt with it. It takes quite a while for the outworking of that, and we are still in the middle of that process, but the day is coming when it'll be done. So here in a nutshell is the wonder of why Christ died. You see, who has died for an enemy. Many people in history have died for noble causes, haven't they? Or for king and country, for a cause, for the workers, or for their art, perhaps. But who dies for somebody who hates them? No one. That is extraordinary love, if that's what you have to call it. That is the love that Christ shows. He went to the cross. He drank the cup in order to protect and love those who trust him. He drank my cup so that I wouldn't have to, so that I could be forgiven. Do you see, this proves that God really is good. In the face of so many other questions, no, God is good because he loves me, you. He wants nobody to perish, but to be forgiven. Then who would ever have solved the enigma of how you can be merciful and just at the same time? Human justice systems seesaw between the two. We can never get it right. The victims cry out for justice. The loved ones of the perpetrator cry out for mercy. How do you do both? Well, God is wise, you see. He knows how to do it. As Paul puts it in one of his letters, he says, so as to be just and the one who justifies, so that he makes sure sin gets its deserts, but that people who plead for mercy will find it. He is incredibly wise. This is God's wisdom that Paul describes. It is way beyond our understanding, and it's proved at the cross. And then finally, who could ever have orchestrated all this? I mean, go away, read one of the gospel accounts for yourself. Mark's is the shortest. Just read maybe the last, I don't know, what, five chapters? Won't take very long at all. And just keep asking yourself, who's in charge here? Who's got this sorted? Is it Pilate? Is it Herod? Is it the Pharisees? Is it the temple priests? Or someone else? You see, JFK sat in the Oval Office. He had the US Secret Service protecting him. He had all the possible mod cons it was possible to have in the early 60s. That couldn't prevent his assassination. Jesus claimed, and I would argue proved, that he is God's living presence on earth. He could have stopped it, but he orchestrated it, and he says, come, let us go. Here is my betrayer, and we're going to walk headlong into an express train. God is powerful. Now, that is not an answer to why there's suffering in the world. There are many mysteries, and I dare say in this life we will not find answers remotely that will help us. But what I want us to hold on to is that at the cross, God has proved that he is all three of these things that we so need him to be, and therefore we can trust him in our darkest hours, because actually there is nothing we experience that can ever possibly be as dark as what he experienced. There is nothing that he endured that is, you know, on the same scale as what we go through. And that is not to belittle it. It's simply to say, in the face of the dark night, we can trust this glimmer of light, that God has acted in history and is on the case. And that, I think, is why, even after something like the trenches of the First World War, if you've seen the film 1917 recently, you'll have had a sense of that. Even as a result of the trenches of the First World War, yes, people lost their faith because they couldn't square that with the reality of God. But conversely, many other people were confirmed in their faith, like C.S. Lewis later on, like Tolkien, like a number of those guys. They were down in the trenches. And they could see that actually this was what sustains you in the middle of your confusion, because this is like a rock surrounded by quicksand. Amen.